y'all. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Welcome back to a Monday edition of The Takeaway. And with less than 2 weeks and only one more weekend before Christmas morning, this was simply a busy weekend of preparation, planning, and shopping for a lot of folks. But throughout parts of the Midwest and South, the past 2 days brought sudden and devastating loss. A series of tornadoes killed dozens, left tens of thousands without power, and leveled communities in 6 states. Most hard hit was the state of Kentucky. Now, when we're faced with these kinds of losses, we just want to express our gratitude for each of you who's able and willing to spend a bit of time with us on this Monday. So let's get into our busy agenda for the day. We're actually going to start by going back to the big headline on Friday out of Washington, D.C. The Supreme Court ruled in the case Whole Woman's Health versus Jackson. And the case involved a preemptive challenge to the Texas abortion law, which went into effect in September. Called the heartbeat law, it bans most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, a period before many people are even aware of being pregnant. The lead plaintiff in the case, Whole Woman's Health, is a privately owned group of health clinics operating in several locations in Texas. And Whole Woman's Health offers comprehensive gynecology services, including abortion care. They describe their approach as, quote, designed to address the shame and stigma attached to abortion. Here's Whole Woman's Health Vice President Andrea Ferrigno.
Every woman that comes through our clinic deserves excellent health care that is free of judgment. I am so proud to work in an organization that genuinely cares about how women experience health care.
On Friday, the Supreme Court issued its ruling, which did not adjudicate whether or not the Texas law was constitutional. Instead, the court ruled about who has the right to challenge the law in federal court. And in an 8-1 decision, the justices decided that abortion providers like Whole Woman's Health can continue to challenge the law. But in the meantime, the law will remain in effect. So on Friday, Amy Hagstrom-Miller, president of Whole Woman's Health, released a statement in response to the ruling. It read in part, quote, "Today marks day 101 that Whole Woman's Health staff have had to turn away Texans seeking abortion care. And with today's Supreme Court decision allowing Senate Bill 8 to remain in effect, the cruelty and heartache that our staff and patients have endured will continue." We're joined now by Dr. Ghazala Moyedi, an OBGYN and abortion provider in Texas and a board member with Physicians for Reproductive Health and Texas Equal Access Fund. Dr. Moyedi, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Melissa. It's such an honor to be back again, but 104 days into this ban, I wish it was under different circumstances.
Yeah, let's start right there. I mean, Amy Hagstrom-Miller's statement described cruelty and heartache as the experience that her staff and patients were feeling. How would you describe your work since SB 8 was instituted this fall?
I would agree completely with Amy that what I'm seeing is unnecessary suffering. And really, the Supreme Court's ruling last week does not change the day-to-day reality of the people I serve and care for in Texas. Our communities continue to suffer from this blatant human rights violation, while the Supreme Court really refused to exercise its power and duty to ensure life and liberty for us, for the people of Texas.
Say a bit more on that. I can hear sort of the beginnings of how you responded to that court ruling, but what do you see as, because, you know, it was reported in so many different ways over the course of the weekend, this sense of, well, it's a victory or it's part victory, part, you know, loss. How do you read and experience it?
You know, it has left us with a lot of questions, of course. We're thankful that at least the provider cases can go forward, but that doesn't change the reality for people today. The court really had a duty to step in and prevent this law from continuing to be enforced, and they did not. And it still could be months, if not a year or more, if we continue depending on this federal path. What I do think this ruling has done for abortion providers in our state is to serve as an internal checkpoint on the course we are going to take. How will we continue to fulfill our duty to care for our communities? You know, Melissa, since this law was signed in May, many providers, including myself, have been asking, what if we don't comply? Or how do we not comply? And I think many folks hoped the Supreme Court would act swiftly to reverse this clearly unconstitutional decision. And so we took that path. Now that it's clear that this court is quite literally acting by design, I'm hearing an appetite from providers to return to a strategy of resistance, especially now because we have also last week had a positive state court ruling in our challenge within the state of Texas. I deeply hope you're going to see from us bolder actions in the future. And the real barrier to that bold action is not a lack of will from Texas providers and abortion funds. It's money. Physicians, nurses, and staff, we're all ready to fight, but we need that financial support to fight this unjust law.
So as you talk about this bold action and direct action, back in October, Dr. Alan Braid wrote in the Washington Post about performing an abortion in direct defiance of the law, and of course, writing about it on purpose to indicate his defiance of the law. Are you suggesting that there may be other providers willing to perform abortions in defiance of the law, but in what you understand to be compliance with current constitutional rights?
Exactly. And what happened last week, in addition to the Supreme Court ruling, is that me, along with other plaintiffs, had sued the state, and we had sued Texas Right to Life and the architects of the bill. And a state court judge in Texas did find last week that several parts of SB 8 are unconstitutional and cannot be enforced. And so we do have a positive state court ruling in Travis County currently. And so for many of us, we see that we are actually able to provide abortion care under that ruling specifically.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit more about what happens in a case of dissent here, because it does go to how this particular law is written. And in fact, Justice Thomas, who was the only dissenter I think it's just worth noting, this was not a decision in Whole Woman's Health versus Jackson, was not a decision that fell along ideological lines per se. It was an 8-1 decision. The only dissenter was Thomas. And in this case, Thomas is saying, the reality is that there have been more challenges to SB 8 than there have been people using that kind of what we, discussed in the media as kind of like a bounty hunter, deputizing the public as a way of enforcing the law. So based on your understanding, both of what's happened in the state court and based on sort of just the number of lawsuits, do you think that deputizing the public aspect was overstated? In other words, are you all in less danger than we initially thought, and you all being providers, or is it still just a latent danger of that kind of legal action?
Yeah, I don't think that fear was overstated in any way. I honestly think that maybe they never intended to sue, and their point was to just get us to stop. And so, we're going to see what happens, hopefully, if we provide and then see if they are going to violate Judge Peoples' decision, his declaratory judgment, and we might have to test the law in different ways.
All right. California, I just want to go to this for a moment. California has signaled this willingness to be an abortion sanctuary state, not only in the case of what's happening in the SB 8 cases, but perhaps even more critically in what happens with the Mississippi case, which it does seem has the possibility of actually overturning Roe v. Wade and kind of the fundamental basis of a constitutional right to seek termination. Based on what you know and understand as a provider and the patients that you work with, what difference does it make, and for what kinds of patients, to have states like California be sanctuary states?
For many of the people that I take care of, even getting to a neighboring state like Oklahoma, Louisiana, or New Mexico is practically impossible. So while I applaud states like California for moving to take action to help communities like ours, I'm skeptical about any action that doesn't involve us in the planning. And I don't know if the people that I take care of every day to day, are going to be able to make it to California. And so that includes communities of color, that includes undocumented communities, people with disabilities, minors. Those are the people that are going to be most impacted by the overturning of Roe v. Wade and by the continuing enforcement of SB 8.
So talk to me a bit about those folks that you serve and what you've been saying to them in recent months. What kind of counsel have you provided for those who have sought abortion services?
Yeah, so my work since this law has gone into effect has changed dramatically. And so the abortion care that I provide now is primarily out of state. And so the people that I'm seeing are the ones that have been able to make it out. And I am seeing people driving from further and further distances, patients telling me that they've lost their jobs because of the amount of days they've had to take off work. Many people that travel to see me or to see us for care really have to bring their whole families as well because they don't have childcare options. They can't fly their whole family either. And so we're talking about removing kids from school from several days so that they can accompany their families too. So there is a ripple effect in our communities from this law. And the other side of it is I'm a practicing OBGYN here in Texas as well, and I take care of birthing people. And so what I have seen also is just this dramatic increase in people with complex medical conditions, mm-hmm. people with complex pregnancies that are unable to leave the state for care. And, you know, we're getting to the point right now where we're going to start seeing the result of this law on the other end, right? That people are actually starting this month are going to start having births that were a result of denial of abortion from this law.
And what will that mean for maternal and infant health outcome, do you think?
I think we are going to see an increase in maternal complications, not just morbidity, but also not just mortality, but also morbidity. I think we will see an increase in neonatal death, and that will simply be a result of pregnancies that we knew were not compatible with life. And so we're going to see dramatic changes in the birth care community across our state, and we already are seeing those changes.
And we have very little time left, but just so that I can affirm this, but you and other providers are in conversation about what you can do next as you wait on these questions about the law. Is that right?
We are, yes.
I so appreciate you taking the time at this very difficult time. Dr. Gazala Moyeti is an OBGYN and an abortion provider in Texas. She's also a board member with Physicians for Reproductive Health and Texas Equal Access Fund. Dr. Moyeti, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
But now we want to understand a bit more about the complicated legal path ahead for challenges to Texas's SB 8. So here to help us out is Melissa Murray, law professor at NYU, faculty director of the Birnbaum Women's Leadership Network, and co-host of the legal podcast, Strict Scrutiny. Great, as always, to have you with us, Professor Murray.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so this was actually sort of complicated. It took us a while to wrap our heads around it. Can you help us understand what the court actually decided and told us on Friday?
Sure. Remember, these two cases that came before the court in November were not about whether or not the Texas law is constitutional. That was put off for another day. This question was purely jurisdictional. Should these lawsuits be in federal court in the first place? Were these the right defendants for the clinic providers to be suing? And in this particular case, the court made two decisions. One, it said that the Department of Justice's suit against the state of Texas could not proceed, but it did allow the clinic providers to continue their suit, but only with respect to a certain number of defendants. So the court said that the clinic providers could not bring their suit against the state court judges and clerks, and those were actually the defendants that the clinic providers really had hoped to continue against, because those are the defendants who are in the best position to stop these private lawsuits from happening. And if you stop the private lawsuits from happening, then the abortion providers have no fear that they will be prosecuted and they can continue providing abortion care in Texas, which is all but stopped in that state. Instead, what the court said was that the state court judges and clerks were not appropriate defendants, but that the licensing professionals, the individuals that give licenses to these doctors in Texas, those were appropriate defendants. The problem, of course, is that those defendants are actually limited in the kind of relief that they can provide. They can stop the state from taking away the abortion providers' licenses or from penalizing them professionally, but they're really not in a position to stop these private lawsuits from happening. And of course, it is the threat of those lawsuits that makes this law so pernicious and that has stopped abortion access in Texas.
Right. Okay. Now, so there's the whole woman's health decision that allows, and that's 8-1, right? That's allowing
right.
this kind of limited set of defendants, but it is allowing providers to bring suit against this limited set of defendants, right? The licensing right. folks. Then there is the one that says, nope, federal government has no business in here. That one's out altogether. What?
Yes. Well, so again, I think... I have to be really clear about this. There are no real winners for reproductive rights in this decision. The only real winner here is the court, because the court has managed to pull off a decision where it looks like it is doing something, but what it has done is actually really limited in terms of restoring abortion access in Texas. And more importantly, they have really curtailed the federal government's ability to step in when states decide that they are going to nullify particular constitutional rights. So the court said that the DOJ could not bring that suit against Texas, which really raises the question, is there anything for the federal government to do when a state like Texas decides it's going to ignore the Supreme Court's decisions altogether?
Okay, well, I want you to pause right there, because Professor Murray, you just used the word nullification and said that maybe states can kind of do what they want relative to the federal government. That we fought a civil war about that, didn't we?
It's a terrifying thought, Melissa, and indeed it is exactly what Justice Sonia Sotomayor raised in her dissent in this case. She would have allowed the suits brought by the clinic providers to proceed against the state court judges and clerks. She also would have allowed the DOJ's suit to proceed, and she made clear what Texas is doing here is akin to what segregationists did after Brown versus Board of Education, and indeed what Southerners did in the lead up to the Civil War. The idea that they can just simply defy what the Supreme Court says, what the federal government says, and decide what rights they will enforce and what rights they will not.
So will the Supreme Court simply give us a couple months and then make a decision in a Mississippi case that will basically reverse what the court has said is even possible here by sort of reversing Roe v. Wade, or at least upturning it in a way that no longer provides the constitutional right to seek an abortion?
So I'm terrible at court prognostication, but it seems likely, given what we saw in the court's oral arguments in that Mississippi case on December 1st and what happened in these decisions, that it looks like the court is poised to seriously retract abortion rights or overturn them entirely. And if that's the case, all of this is moot anyway, because in Texas, there will be no constitutional right to an abortion as a matter of Supreme Court precedent if that happens.
Right. And that I guess is part of, you know, and I appreciate you saying that you're bad at prognostication, because I worry that maybe everyone's bad at Supreme Court prognostication, that it's actually more difficult than we think it is to sort of read the judicial tea leaves about what's coming next. And so I'm wondering, you know, sort of for folks who are really watching this, really from either side on this question, whether or not there are kind of clear indicators in these two Texas decisions about what may happen in Mississippi, or if the legal aspects are so different that we can't look at Texas to figure out what's likely to happen with Mississippi.
Obviously, these are two very different sets of cases, but they are inextricably linked in one respect. The Texas case challenges a law that flagrantly violates existing Supreme Court precedent, whereas the Mississippi case questions whether those precedents should even be observed and deferred to. And so they are linked in that way. And I think what we have seen from these two decisions from the court with regard to the DOJ suit and the clinic provider suit is that the court is really not fully exercised to restore abortion rights in Texas. The fact that they've chosen these particular set of licensing officials to be the proper defendants really limits the amount of relief that can be provided. And that suggests that they're not that interested in restoring this right in Texas, at least not in this particular moment. So I think that's the most we can read from these cases, but it is a very harrowing landscape looking forward for reproductive rights.
We have just 30 seconds left, but President Biden's got a new report about whether or not it's possible to expand the court. Any sense that that is what will happen?
Well, that commission was never charged with making full recommendations, and they issued a report, and there wasn't a great deal of fanfare. I think there was more anticipation about the commission being convened than there was about its reports. But they have made clear that they are supportive of the idea of term limits. They don't think it will take a constitutional amendment to impose term limits, but they're mixed on the question of court expansion, although there have been some dissenting voices from the commission who have said, like Larry Tribe and Nancy Gertner, a former federal judge, that they went into this favoring term limits, but not favoring court expansion, and their positions flipped.
Hmm. Melissa Murray is co-host of the legal podcast Strict Scrutiny. Thanks so much, Professor Murray.
Thank you, Melissa.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Texas doctors confront the reality of the abortion ban.
A violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge and a fine of at least $100,000. After Roe was overturned, the message from doctors was, I'm out of here.
Revisiting the abortion laws in Texas. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. Now, sometimes we say a woman's place is in the house. Well, in 1917, Jeanette Rankin of Montana became the first woman to serve in Congress, 2 years after women in her state won the right to vote, meaning she was in the House. In 1965, Patsy Takamoto Mink, a Japanese-American, became the first woman of color to serve in the House. And just a few years later, in 1969, Shirley Chisholm joined the House of Representatives as the first Black woman member of Congress. Now, in our history, only two Black women have served as U.S. senators, and when Senator Kamala Harris became the vice president in 2021, it left no Black women in the Senate and only three women of color in the Senate. And that's even though the 2018 midterm elections brought historic wins for women elected to Congress. So even though, as the number of women elected to the Congress has grown, that there have been more women in the House, unfortunately, so too has our awareness of the ways that political critiques, well, they far too often track along gender stereotypes. And at times, they even subject these representatives to forms of verbal and discursive gender violence. Here's Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking on the floor of the House in July 2020, after she was accosted by then-Representative Ted Yoho on the steps of the Capitol.
I walked back out, and there were reporters in the front of the Capitol. And in front of reporters, Representative Yoho called me, and I quote, These are the words that Representative Yoho levied against a congresswoman. The congresswoman that not only represents New York's 14th congressional district, but every congresswoman and every woman in this country. Because all of us have had to deal with this in some form, some way, some shape, at some point in our lives.
AOC was also targeted last month when Representative Paul Gosar posted a violent anime video on Twitter depicting him murdering her and attacking President Joe Biden. Democrats in the House censured Gosar and removed him from committee assignments. And just before Thanksgiving, Representative Lauren Boebert was filmed twice making racist comments that suggested Representative Ilhan Omar might be a terrorist. Now, Representative Omar is the first person to wear hijab in the U.S. Congress. And she said that she's received death threats and too many threatening voicemails to count. Here's Representative Omar speaking with Joy Reid on MSNBC.
You know, I'm okay. I have survived things like war, and I'm going to be okay. What I'm worried about is my staff, my constituents, and every single member of the Muslim community who's worried about what this means for them, and without condemnation and punishment for this kind of anti-Muslim, Islamophobic hate would mean for them in their communities.
So far, Boebert hasn't faced any consequences from House leadership for her comments. Representative Ayanna Pressley introduced a resolution last week to strip Boebert of her committee assignments. Joining me now is Kelly Dittmar, an associate professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden, and the director of research and a scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics. Thanks for joining us on The Takeaway, Kelly.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, let's dig in here just for a moment on the numbers. When you look at the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, and you look at the numbers of women and women of color, is this a moment to be celebrating how many folks there are, or to be mourning how few there still are?
I think we can do both. We can celebrate the fact that in the last two elections, particularly in the 2018 election, we saw record numbers of women running and winning elections, and that was across levels. But at the same time, women continue to be underrepresented, or you can talk about it as men being continually overrepresented across these levels of office, and then having some real sites of underrepresentation that I think are especially important. So I would talk here about governors, statewide executives, and in that, really looking at the diversity that is lacking among women in those positions. And so, you know, we have never had a Black woman governor. We have still have really low numbers of women of color in any statewide executive position. So while we can celebrate the increase in the candidate pool and the evidence, the clear evidence that women win when they run, we have to be sure that we're also lifting women up in positions where they continue to be especially underrepresented.
So when I talk about these numbers with my students and they say, well, what can we do? I mean, there's a number of structural things, but one of the things I do is say, look, you just gotta, when you notice brilliant, hardworking, incredibly capable women, say to them, have you ever thought of running for office, right? It's something that we know that boys, right, literally young men, hear pretty frequently and that girls don't. But part of what I want to dig into here is, when I say that to my students who seem to me like, oh, wow, you could someday be great, they look at me and say, why would I run for office, professor? Have you seen how women are treated?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The piece of this that sometimes we miss is you can tell women and encourage women and ask them to run all day. But if you don't make a case that the potential cost, the literal cost, right? It costs a lot of money. And the psychological cost, or the cost of leaving a job or activism or things that they feel like they're making a real difference in. If we don't recognize those costs as maybe unweighed to what they see as the benefits, we're not making an effective case to women to even run. And then, yeah, we have to handle the fact that when they do run, they face disproportionate types and levels of harassment and abuse. And then unfortunately, as we've seen recently, we're also seeing that abuse continue once they get into office. And obviously this isn't new, but we're seeing it and hearing about it more explicitly now, partly because of social media and partly, thankfully, to the women who are in, who are willing to speak out and call it out as inappropriate. The downside, of course, is how do you make the case to other women to run for office when they see this type of abuse?
So let's talk about that language, and you're describing this as abuse. Talk about what we're seeing in terms of, let's call it discursive violence, over and against, particularly women in the House of Representatives who are at the intersections of also being progressive and women of color.
Yeah, I think it's so important to make that distinction, and I'm glad you did. There's, you know, ever since especially in the 2018 election, we saw conservatives, particularly Republicans running for office, who singled out these women, and again, at this intersection, as personifications of threat, right? So the abuse, the sort of characterizations of them as socialists, extremists, radicals, again, threats to the to communities, or they would use words like extreme, right? This is not a coincidence that they are doing this with women in communities, racial and ethnic, religious, and even generational communities that have been marginalized from power and characterized as at the least unfit and at the worst dangerous for being in political power. So we saw this as a campaign tactic. It continued on both from members of the public and, unfortunately, candidates and office holders. And then we see once these women get in office, they continue to be targets because it's used to rile a base that has now been told that this is exactly what you need to campaign against. And again, inseparable from the fact that we're dealing with institutions, campaigns, and elected institutions that are rooted in misogyny and racism.
Now, Kelly, we asked some of our listeners if they thought there's a difference between how the news media treats women versus men in elected office. So let's take a listen.
Hi, this is Shannon from Welch's, Oregon. And I think there is absolutely a difference in how the media portrays female and male candidates. I think the most prime example is discussing a female candidate's obligation to home, things that they're wearing, how they do their hair, discussions about their body type or superficial things. You don't hear these things generally mentioned about male candidates. It's more about their work-related history, the things that they've been successful at. It's never about how they aren't raising their children, what kind of suit they're wearing, what their hair looks like. Just that alone sets the tone so much differently for female candidates. There's an extra hurdle that they have to jump over just to be able to be in the same field as male politicians.
My name is Joseph Ulrich. I'm calling from Vancouver, Washington. I'm a 67-year-old white male, and I have seen the increase in mistreatment and unequal treatment, downright disparaging and degrading treatment by other politicians, which the news media does not cover, specifically women of color, women of different religions other than Christianity, what have you. It is despicable. There is no modicum of respect for the fact that these women fought hard to get to these places, and the news media is not doing a good enough job of covering or calling out even the mildest of these infractions.
Terry, Jackson Heights. Yes, I do think the media covers women differently than it covers men, because I think we still live in a sexist society, and women are treated differently in all industries. You know, we don't talk about the age of men. We don't talk about how they look or how they styled their hair or what they wore. These things are insignificant. And I think there's always this underlying current in when they make these statements that somehow women are less than or they're not fully qualified for the positions that they're in. And that is total sexism.
Hi, I'm Donna from Philadelphia. And is there a difference with the way the media treat men versus women in elected office? All you have to do is ask Hillary Rodham Clinton about that. The way that she was treated during the 2016 presidential election was deplorable. Even now, what's going on with Vice President Harris, the littlest things are made, they're blown up into big stories. She uses Le Creuset pods. She doesn't like wireless ear pods. Supposedly, there's a report where some former staffers have said working for her is, you know, hellish because of what you have to go through. Why didn't anybody talk about the toxic work environment of Mike Pence?
Kelly, let's jump in right there. When we look at media depictions, the stories that mainstream mass media decides to tell about women who hold office, do we in fact tell mean girl stories or focus on aspects of women who are office holders in ways that we don't for men?
Yes and no. So the evidence in terms of academic studies and others who have looked at this certainly finds that there have been differences in both the quantity and quality of coverage. And that quality of coverage is exactly what you're talking about, focusing on different and arguably sexist themes, racist themes, biases, etc., because media knows that it'll get clicked, right? So you might be more interested in a Boebert versus Omar theme because of that catfight narrative than you would of two men who have been going back and forth, like Adam Kinzinger and another more conservative member of Congress. But there's also a piece of this that we have to, I think, push beyond just it's sexist or it's not, and think about the nuance and ways in which gender and race infuse the media coverage and really have a conversation about the implications of coverage. And what I mean here is, it's okay, potentially, right, to talk about Hillary Clinton's emails or to talk about somebody's clothing if it's used as a way of communicating a message. But you have to understand the nuance of how that coverage might be received by an audience in ways that are different because of the audience's own biases. So if you're questioning a woman's honesty, the audience, who is prone to think women are more honest than men, might have a more negative reaction to that. And so there's a more nuanced responsibility of media that might be a lot to ask of them, to say, you have to think about how this particular story is going to read for this particular woman, and be responsible to the biases that are already in the ecosystem in which you're communicating this type of story. So you think about that with likability as well, emotion, things that might be taken differently, unfortunately, because there are these biases at the root.
I think that's such an interesting and important sort of reframe of that, not saying, oh, you just can't talk about this with a woman, but instead trying to have some awareness around, again, not only a woman candidate, but a woman who may be at the intersections of these other identities. I want to take a listen to another call for a moment, because you brought up the issue of media coverage of how women who hold elected office dress. So let's take a moment.
Women in elected office are treated much more strictly in regards to their appearance and their dress than they are to their ideas and issues that they are bringing to the forefront. This is Angela from Charlotte, North Carolina.
How can we, as media, talk about the way that women dress in politics in a way that is actually useful? Because some of what is happening is candidates and office holders are purposely using clothing and fashion to make a statement, and you don't want to ignore it because, well, there's just a rule against talking about that.
Exactly. It's more productive, at least in my opinion, to get at the root about when and why appearance discussion can be biased. So when it's used to discount substance and qualifications, or distract from a message that women are trying to communicate, or to sexualize women in ways that trivialize their power, right? There are all these ways in which focusing on appearance can undermine the power that a woman has in a public space. And those often are pretty obvious when you see those types of uses. But if a woman is using image or her appearance, her dress to communicate a message, ignoring that can also hurt her, right? Because she's doing that purposefully. So when the women wear white to communicate or sort of harken back to women's suffrage, they are trying to communicate a message of solidarity and power. You might, covering that is not sexist. In the case of, I know there's been a lot of attention to Senator Kyrsten Sinema, there is an argument that some of the ways in which she has used appearance is to distract from the fact that she is not willing to talk about substance. She's not willing to talk about her votes. That's a critique that is arguably fair, as long as you're clear about what you think the appearance, you know, what her appearance choices are being used for. And again, I think it's a conversation that can be had if you can raise the nuance of it. In other words, saying, yes, appearance coverage has sometimes worked to disempower or critique women in power, but we also can talk about the ways in which women themselves use it, and here are some possibilities. And of course, Dr. Cottom in the New York Times has done that and started this conversation, and I think there's a continued conversation to have there.
We've talked, you know, in terms of like specific cases here, we've mostly talked about women on the Democratic side of the aisle. But I just want to point out that some of, and I think it's easier for people to see gender bias when it also is directed at women who are in the political party or aligned with the ideological perspective that they have. So just by way of example, I was regularly appalled at how Kellyanne Conway was discussed and talked about during her years as an advisor for President Trump. You know, there may have been plenty of substantive critique to have, but I was stunned at how frequently the language was deployed in ways that were sexist, that, again, used discursive gender violence. And I'm wondering about, like, our ability to see and hear that bias when that person is maybe not in our political party or not aligned with our ideology.
Yeah, I think you're right to point out that it's not as fairly or evenly critiqued. And especially in the current environment where there is such polarization, there is a tendency to stick with your team no matter on what topic. And I think, you know, organizations like ours, work that you're doing, is to say we do have to, if we really want to eradicate this type of violence, it has to be across the board. And it also means that the women who are engaged in that type of violence have to recognize it and also push back against it. And so, of course, we've seen that. We have to be very careful to say that women can engage in it against other women and be sure to say that nobody, unfortunately, is immune from what is really systemic, right? This is at the root of these institutions. I, you know, recall when Ayanna Pressley, after the abuse of AOC from her colleague Ted Yoho, said patriarchy is at home in the hall of these institutions. And she's right. Patriarchy, misogyny, racism is really at home, unfortunately, in our political institutions. And simply having new voices and new bodies is something we advocate for. It's really important in disrupting those institutions and the things that root them. But it doesn't happen overnight. These institutions are stubborn. And so it's going to take calling it out in all forms and against all women.
Kelly Dittmar from the Center for American Women and Politics is an associate professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden, and she does direct research at the Center for American Women and Politics. Thank you for joining us here on The Takeaway, Kelly.
Thank you again for having me.
Today, we have the next piece of our series, Aging While Queer, which chronicles the experience of aging as an LGBTQ plus elder. Throughout the series, we've looked at what it's like aging with HIV, finding affirming housing as an LGBTQ plus elder, and today we're looking at what it's like coming out at an older age. Pat Henschel and Terry Donahue met on an ice rink in Saskatchewan, Canada in the late 1940s and fell in love, but spent decades hiding their relationship from the world. Their love story, which also became the two women's coming out story, was made into a 2020 Netflix documentary called A Secret Love.
Pat and Terry, with the exchange of your vows and your rings, you have begun in law that which has existed in faith and in love for very nearly 70 years.
With us now is the director of that documentary, Chris Bolin. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Melissa, for having me.
So let's begin with this secret love story. Tell us about Pat and Terry.
Yeah, so Pat and Terry are two extraordinary women. They are also my relatives, my great aunts. Terry was my biological aunt. She's the baseball player, and Pat is her partner. You know, they've been in my family for obviously over 50 years. Both Canadian, grew up in the prairies on farms in Saskatchewan. And Terry came down to play professional baseball in the 1940s. And during her winter break, met Pat playing hockey up in the town of Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan.
The unmarried auntie as part of family dynamic is very much a part of sort of my multi-generational experience, right? And there is typically in my household, a presumption that unmarried auntie is also queer auntie, even when that hasn't always been true. But certainly if unmarried auntie was also an athlete, then that would be the presumption.
The question came up over and over and over, over the decades, were they partners? And, you know, they said no multiple times. And, you know, we have to remember that obviously they're born in the 1920s and grew up in the 1940s. So It was very, very taboo. You know, we are in a different place now, obviously. We still have a ways to go, but it was dangerous back then. So the family did have, you know, questions about their relationship. But when they said that they were just friends and that they were living together in Chicago because the rent was expensive, the family just believed them.
So let's talk about that a bit and what it means to be queer auntie in a loving, long-term relationship. But when asked point blank by your family, who you also love, whether or not this is your life partner, you have to say no.
Yeah, you know, I can't imagine what that must have been like for them. Over and over and over saying no, and what that must have felt like to Pat, you know, Terry telling her family no, that she's just a friend, and what that must have felt like for Terry, from Pat telling her brother Al, who was extremely homophobic, no, Terry's just a good friend of mine. You know, they hit it so well, in fact, that Pat's brother Al, who, as I mentioned, is very homophobic, you know, loved Terry, and I think probably would have wanted to marry Terry, because he just thought that Terry was Pat's good friend. So, you know, this hiding and this double life was so hard for them, especially for Terry, which is why near the end of her life, she made a comment in the film, and this was true, obviously, that she said she just couldn't go to her grave feeling like she was living a lie. And so finally, after 7 decades of hiding, to their biological family, Terry just said she needed to tell the truth. And it was amazing, Melissa, to see the transformation that came over both of them once that burden had been lifted.
So you made that important distinction about biological family because they had family, they had community, found family.
Exactly.
Who were aware of who they were and what they meant to each other. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, so they had these two lives. They had their found family of friends that were in Chicago, and they had their biological family, which obviously were their blood family up in Canada. And they kept those two worlds completely separate. To their found family, they were the loving lesbian couple, open and free. And to their found family, they would have to hide that part of themselves every time they'd come up to trips to Canada. They would sleep in different bedrooms. They wouldn't share a bed, obviously. So they navigated those two identities for decades.
Say more about, and I think you've hinted at this, about, you know, there were obviously these costs of keeping it hidden, but this is our Aging While Queer series. Mm-hmm. And so say a bit about why it mattered, even after decades and after decades of having found family and community. Why did it matter to tell the biological family and maybe most critically, to marry?
You know, our aging LGBTQ elders, it's funny. I mean, we're losing all of them, people of that generation, and their stories are disappearing with them. And, you know, it's interesting because that generation in particular, as I was filming as we were making the movie, watching them navigate coming out was fascinating and just so, you know, so moving. Oftentimes, Melissa, I think that a lot of people of that generation don't come out. They have a number of friends who have gone to their grave that have never come out to their family just because of the time that they grew up in. If the 40s was dangerous, you were arrested, you were lobotomized, it was treated as a disease that you could be cured. You know, there's in Chicago, they were telling me stories of principals and teachers' lives being ruined, people committing suicide, being outed in the newspaper. So that sticks with you. And so, I mean, it took a tremendous amount of courage for Terry and Pat to come out. And, you know, Terry wouldn't have come out. I mean, Pat wouldn't have come out had Terry not pushed her. You know, Pat, I think, would have been fine hiding. But Terry just, as I said, couldn't keep that secret anymore. So, and then it was interesting, Melissa, noticing this kind of this twice closeted effect that happened once they had moved out of their house into the assisted living facility. They had taken this courageous step to come out to their biological family, and then they move into an assisted living facility with that generation of people, and they ended up kind of going back into the closet.
I so appreciate you bringing up that aspect. In our Aging Wild Queer series, that was one of the first conversations we had. And it was and continues to be, I think, this like knife twist for me, this idea of what it takes, particularly for our elders of that generation, right, of this this moment when so much of society was opening, but not around that identity. And to find that in one's elder years, that we already have such limited options for healthy and fulfilling spaces for our elders to live out, you know, these kind of fabulous final years, but to have to do so again with that protective cover that forces you to pretend you're someone other than who you are.
Yeah, you know, we could have made a whole film, Melissa, just off of that, because it was something that revealed itself as they were transitioning from their home into the assisted living facility. And it was interesting that, you know, for those of your audience who have seen A Secret Love, that wedding scene took place in the assisted living facility, but they told everybody who lived there that it was Terry's birthday party. So they didn't feel comfortable with everybody knowing. Now, they did have certain members, the staff were very supportive, who they were open to, but from the actual residents, they really kept that hidden. And they just, I asked them point blank, I said, why, how does that make you feel? And why do you feel the need not to be truthful? And they said, it's none of their business. And they just wouldn't understand.
Chris Bolin, thank you so much for this thoughtful conversation, for this documentary, and for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa. Thanks for your great questions.
That's all we have for you today, folks. But before I go, we here at The Takeaway wanted to once again send out our deepest condolences to the families who lost loved ones or their homes this weekend from those devastating tornadoes in multiple states in the Midwest. The holiday season is challenging enough being in the midst of a pandemic, so this is just so unimaginable for so many, and we're sending our strength and our love to all of you. If you or a family member experience these tornadoes and you want to share your story with us, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. We always love hearing from you, and we especially want to hear from you if you're having a tough time. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. We'll be right back here tomorrow.